This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Does it feel like just about everyone you know is playing Wordle, Connections, or the Washington Post's mini crossword puzzle? Word puzzles are having a moment, and today we're going to talk about why. Joining me now are author of the book The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle, Anna Steckman. Thanks so much for being here, Anna.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And University of Cincinnati English professor Michael Griffith. Thanks for being here, Michael.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Anna, what were the earliest word puzzles? Are there any that date back to ancient times?
There are. The Satori word square is the sort of progenitor for the modern crossword puzzle, and it had words that read the same vertically as horizontally. I don't know if you can imagine that in your mind, but it's quite difficult to construct. No black squares.
Yeah, it sounds difficult. What's been the allure, Anna, historically of these puzzles? Is it about being the puzzle creator who can stump other people or being the person smart or clever enough to solve the puzzle?
You know, I can't speak for everybody. I can speak for myself. You know, I actually started writing crossword puzzles when I was 15 years old. And I think I was, you know, I wasn't actually writing them for others to stump anybody else. I was just trying to get words to cross in my graph paper notebook, which I had from my, you know, geometry class. And, you know, I think there was something about, you know, some very physical manifestation of my brain power, you know, something that really said I can do something extremely challenging and almost control what seems to be uncontrollable, like the body of language. Clearly, I was struggling to feel empowered as a teenager.
Michael, why did you start writing word puzzles?
It's weird. I was on the show several years ago because I wrote a book about Spring Grove Cemetery, and that came out of a novel. I'm a novelist primarily, and I was writing a novel about the end of newspapers around the turn of the millennium, and it involved a crossword puzzle divisor and an obituary writer, and I thought I had to research both those things. The research into obituary writing resulted in that book, and the research into puzzling got me started teaching myself to devise first crossword puzzles and then acrostics and hinkpinks.
Anna, when was the crossword puzzle invented? I read it was maybe 1913. That doesn't seem very old.
That's right. Yeah, the modern crossword was invented in 1913, and it actually doesn't look very much like the crossword puzzle that you'll see in your newspaper today. It was a diamond shape, and it had all sorts of, you know, two-letter words, which is a big no-no in today's construction. And it was kind of untamed. It had, you know, misspelled words or the same word multiple times in the puzzle. And it wasn't until Margaret Ferrer, at the time was named Margaret Petherbridge, who was kind of a decorous housewife in a way, and she tidied up the puzzle the way she would tidy up a home.
Michael, how has the digital experience, like having smartphones in our pockets, changed the game when it comes to word puzzles?
Well, I mean, Anna's going to know a lot more about this than I do because I just started recently and I never started with graph paper.
Okay.
I envy and admire those who can do it. But I mean, the one thing is there are all kinds of crutches for construction that have to do with giving yourself autofill that you can then manipulate. The problem is that's a great resource, but you cannot overuse it. And if you overuse it, you end up with a flat or dull or jargon-filled puzzle. So it's helpful to know that you have that as a backstop, or if you get into a corner that's tricky, but you really don't want to over-rely on it. But Anna's going to know a lot more about that than I do.
Well, and also, Anna, from the user experience, it seems like that's really kind of changed the game for people, the fact that they've got these smartphones and it opens the door to all these other word puzzles, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It also importantly introduces a timer into the crossword puzzle solving experience. I was actually just at the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament last weekend, which is a speed solving tournament. And I had the strange, I guess, pleasure of watching 1,000 speed solvers tear through a puzzle I'd written. Clearly, they've been training with timers, but now everyone can.
Wow. Anna, people have a lot of theories about strategy. You're a crossword genius, as I understand it. Do you have any go-to strategies to solve crossword puzzles? Asking for a friend who happens to be named Selena Reeder and is a crossword fanatic and also producer of this show.
Well, I have to say, I have to repudiate the title of genius. That's not how I identify. But there's all sorts of ways to get a sort of toehold in the puzzle, in the grid. An easier day of the week, which is at least how the Times establishes their difficulty, is an earlier day in the week, will have more black squares and therefore more small words, which tend to be easier to solve. So I would always try to find those words that that can help get your foot or your toe in the grid. The other thing that I don't think most people do is to acknowledge the byline, right? Most people think almost that they don't think about crossword constructors. Wonder why. But they often think that that puzzles are like computer generated or they're all written by Will Shorts, but there are different puzzle makers, and I find that it actually really changes my solving experience if I know who the puzzle maker is. And there are certain constructors that I feel like I have a very special mind meld with them, and others that are going to stump me every time. And that's a function of the fact that a puzzle is kind of an index of its maker's imagination. The things that the words and phrases that delight them or excite them are, will be found in the puzzle.
You're nodding vigorously, Michael.
That's absolutely true, and absolutely my experience too. There are certain constructors that you feel a kinship with, and their areas of special expertise or interest align with yours, or their as many imaginations align with yours, as Anna said. And I'm a big fan of her puzzles, actually. So
Oh,
it's
there
a
you go.
pleasure for me to get to meet her.
Oh,
So.
thanks so much.
Well, Michael, I understand you are creator of Hink Pinks. Briefly explain for people who aren't familiar what's a Hink Pink.
Hink, the way I was introduced to Hink Pinks, there was a guy named Dylan Hicks, who is a musician and novelist, who used to write a difficult puzzle every month for Paris Review. And one of the puzzle genres he was interested in was the Hink Pink. And the Hink Pink is a it's it seems complicated, but it's actually simple. It's a rhyming puzzle. The rhyme must be perfect, and it's got a fulcrum. There's a midpoint. So a Hink Pink is a two-syllable puzzle where both words rhyme. According to the rules, there can be an apostrophe S or a plural S in the middle. And then a Hinky Pinky is two syllables on either side of the rhyme. And so an example would be like a straight, some of them can be diabolical. And they often involve a kind of bizarre micro narrative that has absurdity in it. But a straightforward one would be Jay-Z up to the moment of his marriage. And the way you figure out a Hink Pink is you have to have one side, you have to figure out one side or the other, and then figure out what it rhymes with. So in this case, you can solve it either by knowing what the name for someone up to the moment of a marriage is, fiance, or by associating him with the person he's most associated with, Beyonce. So it's the answer would be Beyonce's fiance.
Ah, and now am I right that part of a Hink Pink is to know how many syllables the words should have? So, as you said, Hink Pink is
Is
one
one on
syllable.
either side.
Yeah. So, how does it grow? It becomes, then you have to, it's not a Hink Pink
It's a
anymore.
Hinky Pinky would be two. Hinkley Pinkley is the version I learned for three, although these vary. Hinkle diddle, pinkle diddle is four on either side, and then hinkle diddle do, pinkle diddle do is five on either side. Those can be really, really complicated.
Yeah, that sounds kind of like it could be a little brain painful. Anna, is this mental distraction, these word puzzles? Is this a way to think about something else besides everyday problems and stressors? What do you think is a factor that's made these puzzles so popular?
Well, Margaret Farrer, who I mentioned before, she famously said, "You can't think of your troubles when solving a crossword puzzle." And I think there's some truth to that. If you look at the history, we mentioned that it emerged as this form during in 1913, but it had a real renaissance in the 1940s when Farrer introduced the puzzle at the Times in 1942. And of course, we've seen that there are a huge number of new puzzle subscriptions and indie crosswords that emerged during the COVID-19 pandemic. So it seems to actually be a form that's kind of runs parallel to the history of kind of national drama with World War I, World War II, and the pandemic. The strange thing about the satisfactions of solving a crossword puzzle is that it's a leisure activity, but it's also intellectual labor. And I always kind of wonder, why do people like to feel like they're working in their off hours? And I wonder if it's because it's, you know, you can feel like you're working to completion, you've finished something, as opposed to the sensation of kind of endless work, always having to tend to your emails that kind of marks our work time today.
How long have Hank Pink's been around, Michael?
I'm both glad you asked that and horrified that you asked that, because I have never been able to figure out the origin of the Hank Pink.
Really?
There are those who, like, I mean, for example, I have half a dozen friends who are just addicted to them. I do a set of them every summer that appear in the fall issue of Southern Review, and about 60 or so. And there are four or five people who are fanatically devoted to them. And then most people, like, that's not their thing. But they're really represented quite scantily on the internet. There are very few references, and I can't find anything about the history of the Hank Pink. They've been around for at least 20 years, but I don't know beyond that.
Yeah, I'm going to guess even longer, because at first this triggered a fuzzy memory in my old brain. And I remembered that when I was a kid in the, like, this is going back to the 1970s, one of my very best friend's dad was really into these. But I think he sometimes called them stink pinks. And maybe they were more PG-13 than a Hank Pink. I'm not sure. But yeah, I think I can remember. And he would call them stinky pinkies or stinkity pinkity. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Depending on the syllables. So
that sounds right.
Yeah. I think they've been around for a while. They're fun. Anna, how do you think social media has had an impact on these? And I'm thinking specifically not just of crossword puzzles, but also Wordle and Connections and these games that people like to post their scores on social media. What role do you think that's playing in all this?
Well, I think you nailed it, right? People are very interested in sharing their scores and their streaks. You know, it's like what I said about the fact that there's a timer now on the crossword. So the competitiveness of these different games has definitely, you know, risen to the surface, the ability to share your scores and streaks online, or maybe the kind of obsessiveness. I know certain people who will, you know, leave a dinner party so that they don't break their streak, right? That's never been my relationship to puzzles. I always think about them as a way to waste time, not beat it.
Well, and, you know, Michael, these seem like such solitary exercises at times, but my younger daughter is in this group where they share their Wordle scores. It's like a little, almost a team thing, and who gets the bragging rights? Can these games be ways to build community?
I think there's no question about that. And in the case of Wordle in particular, it emerged, the Wordle craze happened in the middle of the pandemic, and that's not accidental. It was a way when people were feeling isolated to have a kind of community. And I know that in my case, there are several sets of friends that I have a set of friends that I do the Wordle with, and we correspond about it every day. There are several other friends that I do Quordle, which is the Wordle times four with. It really becomes an excuse to keep in touch with people that you otherwise might not, and just to make that a daily habit. And it can be a really gratifying way of building a kind of social connection or maintaining one.
Yeah. And I know these puzzles are about more than games for you. Tell us about your book and how personal you got about your relationship with crosswords in your book.
Yeah, well, I was motivated to write this book for two reasons. One is I actually wanted to understand, and I said before that I started writing them when I was 15, and I wanted to understand why, especially because almost to the day I actually started writing crossword puzzles and I stopped eating. I developed a very pernicious teenage eating disorder. Thankfully, I'm in a very secure recovery now, but I thought there was some connection between the two. And then the other reason I wanted to write this book was I'm now one of very few women who writes crossword puzzles. I just saw a tweet that said something like only 18% of the puzzles in the Times right now this year have been written by women. But I also knew that there was this longer history in which women mostly wrote crossword puzzles, and they were sort of coded as women's work. And that many of the sort of innovations of crossword puzzle form were developed by women who also, as it turns out, had a sort of punishing relationship to their bodies or to other women or to the very idea of being a woman. And they actually helped me make sense of this sort of aspect of my own personal history. And also I was just interested in how a kind of profession or field goes from being sort of women dominated to male dominated. And so there's, you're right, a kind of personal aspect, my own personal history, but also this larger social historical project. Why is it that it was mostly women who wrote them and now it's mostly men?
Well, and that brings to mind what you said earlier, which is, you know, you can have a connection with the person who created the puzzle. Did that come into your research? I mean, did you feel like you were building connections with these women who were early creators? And, you know, I guess I wonder how you followed that string through your book.
Yeah, well, they're all really fascinating and really complicated women. We have suffragist, a sort of conservative housewife. We have a self-taught Joyce scholar, cryptanalysts, some Lacanian analysts, and one lesbian separatist who was writing lesbian separatist crossword puzzles in an idiom meant just for women. And that really interests me because the question of whether there is such thing as women's language and whether that will be represented in a puzzle is something that has definitely preoccupied me as I've been solicited to write puzzles sort of as a woman in order to diversify different editors' bylines. You know, there's so many kind of questions about the politics of language that open up when you start to think about what is a puzzle-worthy word and what is the project of sort of patrolling the bounds of common knowledge. What should we expect other people to know? These are the questions that crossword editors have to ask all the time. And it's, even though it is a game, this is sort of weighty political questions.
We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Ed. Thanks so much for calling. What did you want to talk to us about?
Hi. I heard your discussion about the use of smartphones and how that affects puzzle solving these days. I'm retired. And I kind of mourn the time when, if we didn't know something about, like, World War II, we would call my dad. Or if we wanted some other historical perspective or a baking question, we'd call my mom. So I, in this time, I know that my kids will never call me to try to solve a clue on a crossword puzzle. And it was kind of a nice thing to call your expert, phone a friend, you know, as they were. Like we did in the old days.
Yeah.
So that's all I have to say.
Well, thanks, Ed. Appreciate that. What do you think of that, Michael? Is that something we've kind of lost a little bit?
I mean, that's another of the community aspects of it, right? It's an excuse to be in touch with, in intimate ways, with people you care about. And so, I mean, to me, that registers as a real loss. I mean, one of the other things that comes to mind there is this is connected to what Anna was talking about the idea of common knowledge. I mean, the crossword puzzle has to renew itself for subsequent generations over and over again. If the puzzle becomes the refuge of octogenarians who think that common knowledge is all about opera and football, football codes as male in some way. Like, you've got to, the SAT has gone through the same thing. Like, what is it? How is it that you modernize the puzzle? How is it that you consider as legitimate domains for the puzzle all kinds of teen speak and things that come from different subcultures within? And Anna's one of the people who's been, I think, really good at incorporating that stuff into her puzzle. So, I mean, that's the way that puzzles stay relevant.
Yeah. Do you think they help keep people sharp? We're running out of time, but just in a few seconds, I have relatives who insist on doing them to keep their minds sharp. Do you think they help in that way?
I can't testify to the science, but I think it seems that way to me.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with author of the book, The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle, Anna Schechtman, and University of Cincinnati English professor Michael Griffith. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.